Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org, and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back and to talk about all things destructive cults in the message. A lot of people don't really know this history because they lump everybody into the same basket. And when you see some, I hate to use the word, but there's no other word to describe it. When you see some lunatic that's gone rogue, even within the message sect and many of its primary splinter groups, they disavow those that go to the extreme. And what's odd about this is whenever I first started examining William Branham and his prophecies, and then suddenly discovered that he was changing his prophecies over time and that there's actually real question as to whether he even had a prophecy at all. I was looking at the verse, what's it from Matthew 7, I think it is, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, because inwardly they're ravenous wolves." And you know, as I'm examining the prophecies, I'm really dwelling on that. I'm thinking about the false prophet who's humble and sincere from the outside, but inside they're filled with evil. And I never really continued on. But after you really take a step back, you start to continue to read in that passage, it says, "You will know them by their fruits." And it gets to the part where it says, "A good tree cannot bear good fruit." And therefore you know them by their fruits, essentially, is what it's saying. And I began to think about all of the various splinter groups from the message. You had the main sect, which we've talked about, and it's just filled with rotten fruit. We've gone through it. And you've probably seen it in the comment feeds. People come on there and they say, you can't condemn the whole message by these bad apples that are in here. But yes, you can. That's exactly literally what the Bible says. You know them by the fruit. You know them by the bad apples. But then those bad apples produce worse bad apples, and those worse bad apples produce even worse bad apples. So now that we're getting into the splinter groups, we're going to actually do what the Bible is instructing us to do. We're going to examine the message by its fruit.
That's very true, John. You know, we have, if our listeners remember, we have been working for, I don't know, I think this is about episode 30, working our way through the history post-Branham, and specifically looking at the different sects of the message. I think at this point we've went through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think we've went through 5 of what I consider the major sects of the message. And there's still one more major sect we need to cover, which is the main sect, John. And maybe we'll get there on the other side of this next few episodes. But between the 5 and 6, I'll say the 6 to 7 major sects of the message, there you will find, I would say, in those groups have 75 to 80% of the total message population is in those 7 or so sects of the message, the way that I would categorize it anyway. But you still have this other 25% of the message following that's not really in one of those larger sects, those larger international fellowships. And those are what we want to talk a little bit about next. We're going to talk about some of those more prominent ones in that other 25%. And you're correct, John. When people up from the outside a lot of times look at the message, they don't realize that there are all of these sects. And while there are, you know, 7 or 8 large major international sects, there are dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds, John, of smaller, tinier, minor regional sects in the message as well that hates everybody. There might be 50 of them in a church somewhere, and they're the only people that are going to make it, right? There's quite a few of those, John. I mean, it's hard to say how many because they're so isolated, right? They cut themselves off, they wall themselves off, and they are, you know, they have no contact even with the mainstream of the message anymore. So it's hard to even know, you know, what's even going on there. A lot of them are in a, you know, place there's just no way to have any real knowledge of them or what's going on. But there's potentially hundreds of those. There's certainly dozens and dozens. But I want to refer everyone back again to just a little diagram chart I have showed a number of times. This is a high-level diagram chart, John, showing the the main sect of the message here on the left, and then on towards the right, how the different factions of the main sect gradually broke away and produced some of these other sects. This is by no means anywhere near comprehensive, but this is just to give an idea of where some of the sects are coming from. Because when you think of the main sect of the message, the main sect of the message is not like the message people think of a denomination, in the sense of they're not monolithic. The main sect of the message is not monolithic in its views or its beliefs. The main sect of the message is best viewed as a coalition of subgroups with differing interpretations of the message and different models and methods for doing their services and things. And they all get along together because they respect Branham. That's the best way, I think, to view the main sect. And over time, though, the main sect starts, it pushes out the people who are least conforming, right? The anti-church order group was gradually pushed away. The quotes preachers were gradually all pushed out in several different waves. And as you come up to modern times, you know, I'm thinking, you know, the 2000s, the late 90s and 2000s, the main sect of the message becomes increasingly tape church oriented, right? Because what's happening over time is the churches that have live preaching gradually are becoming less and less, more and more of a minority within the main sect, and the tape churches are gradually rising to become the majority. Because it's generally the preaching churches that are getting pushed out or schisming out, because the people who just listen to the tapes are more apt to stay in the main sect. Well, anyways, as we come along today, we're going to start talking about some of these minor groups, which also in some way split away from the main sect of the message. And so the very first one, John, that I think we want to talk about today is the sect of Estel Beeler. Estel Beeler. And so who is Estel Beeler? Let me talk about him just a little bit. Estel Beeler is an old-time message preacher. He is actually, Estel Beeler baptized your grandpa, John, and when he converted into the message. Estel Beeler baptized Raymond Jackson, the pastor of our church, who converted into the message. So this gets you an idea how far back Estel Beeler is. Estel Beeler was in the message before Raymond Jackson, before Willard Collins. He is one of the very earliest message preachers. And he was attending the Branham Tabernacle. He was actually a healing evangelist who traveled the revival circuit during the 40s and 50s, you know. Not in William Branham's party, but as like a parallel working evangelist. And he was in Voice of Healing magazine and stuff. But he lived in Georgetown, Indiana. And he ended up fellowshipping at the Branham Tabernacle. So Estel Beeler was just a fairly important person. He was really, in the early days of the message, he was one of the most senior preachers. He was right there with Orman Neville, with your grandfather, with Raymond Jackson. You know, he was here before Lee Vail, before Perry Green, before Ed Biskol, before pretty well any other message preacher you could think of. He's one of the very first message preachers, and that carried a lot of weight. So what happened, John, is when William Branham died, Estel Beeler had a dream or a vision. It gets tad fuzzy. I think it was a vision. And in his vision, he sees a church and he sees the word Ichabod wrote over the door. And this is how Estel Beeler's following was labeled. They were the Ichabod group. Okay, he saw Ichabod over the door. And he interpreted that vision to mean that the glory of God had departed church buildings, and it was now a sin to have a service in a church building. Henceforth, there should only be house churches. Okay? So he breaks away from Branham Tabernacle, from our sect of the message, John. You know, everyone still kind of fellowship back in those days in the later 60s. He breaks away very early on. I would say by 68, 69, he's broke away with this. And he's convinced a number of people in Indiana, in Ohio, in Kentucky, a little bit in Missouri, that they need to only meet in house churches. And so he develops a house church circuit, right? Has a little following there. But what he does, John, and this is where he gets really interesting, he develops the belief, and he gets this out of William Branham's serpent seed teachings, he develops the belief that it is a sin to continue to have marital relations. And he insists a blanket doctrine of celibacy across all of his followers. Well, this was about 60 years ago, John. So as you can imagine, there's not many more of them left, right? They didn't reproduce like the other sects of the message. So they're pretty well a dead sect of the message today. But they all went, they became celibate. They didn't convert a lot more people in, and they eventually faded away. But that was a big deal, actually, him doing that back in the late 60s and early 70s. That was a really pretty big deal. And a significant number of people in this area followed him and went off into his house church, his celibate house church stuff. And probably the worst thing that happened, John, is when he started preaching the celibacy stuff, actually, quite a few women and men separated and divorced each other because they, accepted his belief that, they needed to be celibate. So he actually broke up quite a few families with that teaching, which caused a pretty big pushback from, like from the Branham Tabernacle, from our church, because they were upset that he was breaking up marriages. And obviously the people he were converting was the people in our churches. John, you're the Brett Tabernacle Faith Assembly Fellowship. That was where he was drawing his convert from. So that's Estill Beeler, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, it's kind of funny because when I first began all of this, I had many people, including one of William Branham's son, who started proclaiming that the reason that John is coming out and sharing all of the critical flaws with the message and all of the failed prophecies was because I had a vendetta against my grandfather. And I loved my grandfather. I was a little surprised when they said that, because many of the people who said that really didn't even know me, did not know my relationship with my grandfather. And I didn't realize at that time that it was just a cult strategy to try to persuade people not to listen to the critical flaws that I was exposing. But they came out and they said that I had this vendetta against my grandfather. But then whenever I got really, really deep into William Branham's life story and all of the history that he just blatantly lied about, including spiritual history, things that without those spiritual experiences he's describing, there is no message. When you take them away, there is no message. Once I got to that point, then they said, John has a vendetta against William Branham. He just hates William Branham, and he's working for the Catholic Church. That's really how it came to be. But, you know, in hindsight, William Branham, I kind of feel sorry for him. I know he had mental health issues. He even mentioned it on recording that he suffered severely with mental health issues. And I have a passion for helping people that are like this. I have a passion, and I feel really bad that this exists. This is a problem that I wish that the medical science could overcome. However, they did not, and William Branham had mental health issues. And the irony is, I really can't even blame him, but I can blame Estill Beeler. Estill Beeler, like you said, is the one who recruited my grandfather. And, you know, it's funny because by and large, they've mostly disavowed Estill Beeler and his weird ministry because of the weirdness you're describing. It wasn't until probably 5 years after I left the message that I even knew that he was the one that recruited my grandfather. My grandfather's own testimony, and there are versions of this online, you can go hear it. He doesn't claim that he's recruited by Estill Beeler. He claims that he just accidentally stumbled onto a meeting in Macon, Georgia. And how does that happen? How do you accidentally go from Indiana to Macon, Georgia? And I never really stopped and thought about it. Why is he leaving out the most important part of the story? I stumbled onto this meeting in Macon, Georgia, and, oh, by the way, I was recruited into the message by Estill Beeler. So there are so many issues with these men covering all of these things up. But Estill Beeler, like you said, was a nut, for lack of a better word. And what's also odd about this is, as I began to study the theology itself, and I'm not going to go deep into the theology, that's for other people, but I did study theology after I left, and I also studied both sides. I studied the good theology, and I studied reputable people who were talking about the bad theology and why it exists. Much of it can be traced all the way back to Gnosticism, and so I wanted to know what this was. I started reading everything I could. In fact, I started reading, one of the first things I read were the writings of Irenaeus, who William Branham said was one of the one of the church age messengers. And you know, I'm reading through all of this, and he talks about the Gnostic groups, how they rose, how they adopted many pagan ideas, blended those pagan ideas with Christianity, and then he walks you through the various sects, kind of like we're doing, honestly. But he, one of the groups, he said, and they decided that it was a sin to have sex with one another, and therefore this group died out. And I was thinking about how odd that is, and I never really connected the two. At that point in time, I did not realize that Estelle Beeler was the one who recruited my grandfather. But it is a mess, and it is not Christianity. This is not how people behave as Christians. But here we have one of the fruits of the message.
You made a really good point there, John, about how people cover up how they came into the message. Lots of people do this, and the reason they do is exactly what you were describing there, John. Every single person who is in the message today is in the message because someone in their background who was a thief, a criminal, a polygamist, a rapist, a homosexual, is the one who converted them in. There is nobody in the entire world who is in the message today who did not convert because of one of these nuts. That's the truth. If you subtract Ewald Frank, who we did whole episodes on, and Sidney Jackson, the polygamist we've talked about a lot, and Perry Green, the criminal we've talked, if you subtract those three things, you don't have a message in Africa, John. It takes those three men to get the millions of people in Africa, right? Like, this message spread because of people like this. And when you hear people say, oh, these people don't matter, we can move on without them, right? That it's so, this sounds rude. It's ignorant, and it's really very ignorant-minded people to even think that way, because they only are in the message because of those people, and they're so ignorant of their own history because people lied about who converted and who did this and that they don't even are aware that this is the reason that they're in the message. But yes, John, I mean, your grandfather and the pastor of my church were both baptized and we could even say in some way converted in by Estelle Beeler, who was an absolute nut. Yeah, absolutely. Right, and it goes even further back, and then. I mean, I loved Raymond Jackson, just, in a lot of ways you loved your grandfather. But I mean, the truth is, Raymond Jackson was a nut too, who did a lot of bad things. Pardon me for saying anything bad about your grandfather, but your grandfather was a nut who did a whole bunch of bad stuff too, who converted a bunch of people to the message. So it just passes on and on and on. Let's go to the next one. And I think this one, John, is an excellent contrast to the last one. So Estelle Beeler, his sect came in and they went celibate. Well, the next sect we're going to talk about went polygamist, which gives you just the message is the spectrum, right? All the way from celibacy to polygamy, from no gifts of the spirit to the gifts have ceased to let's go crazy with the gifts. Like, it's every spectrum is in the message, ladies and gentlemen. So let's talk about the original polygamist sect of the message. So, and ladies and gentlemen, if you want more about these, I have more in my book on all of these than I'm going to be talking about here, along with some different footnotes and stuff that you can reference for sources. And when I talk about J.T. Parnell and the polygamists, John, the hardest thing for me with these sort of groups are they have left behind so many victims. And I look at a lot of the women as victims and the women's children as victims, J.T. Parnell's children. I look at a lot of these people as victims. And so I'm very reluctant to say things that are going to put the victims in a hard spot, right? Because you know how it is in the message, John. I mean, they will harass the victims. It will not be good. So, I mean, I try to approach these things in a way where I'm telling you the truth, but I'm also trying to not expose so many details that the victims become targets, because they didn't they didn't ask for that. I mean, these kids didn't ask to be born into polygamist homes, and these women that got into these things, a lot of them became tricked and then trapped. So anyways, J.T. Parnell. So who is J.T. Parnell? J.T. Parnell was the pastor of The Jerusalem Tabernacle in Edmundston, Kentucky. That's about, maybe an hour drive from Jeffersonville. And his church was founded in 1958. It was one of the very first message churches. He was one of the original message churches, John. J.T. Parnell visited the Branham Tabernacle a lot. And just like Estelle Beeler, you'll find William Branham talking about J.T. Parnell on tape a lot. J.T. Parnell preached fairly regularly at the Branham Tabernacle, very well known here in the Jeffersonville message community. So I've also pointed out before that J.T. Parnell, one of his wives, plural, helped write the Church Age book, typed up some of the initial manuscripts of that working with Lee Vail. So anyways, Parnell, he had a pretty close relationship with William Branham. When William Branham died, he fell in with the pro-church order faction, John. So he was like continuing to fellowship with your grandfather, the Branham Tabernacle, the Tucson Tabernacle. He was in that group at first, even though he was a polygamist. But his polygamy actually started, according to lots of witnesses. I have some quotes in my book. He started practicing polygamy in 1965. He actually started recruiting the week after William Branham preached marriage and divorce. He started recruiting other people to come practice polygamy with him. It started while William Branham was alive. That's very important to notice and recognize. And it is not, I don't think, the least bit controversial to say this man's a polygamist. He had a harem. They traveled with him all over the place. He had a very obvious harem that he took with him from place to place. And it is just a well-known fact that the man was a polygamist. He was publicly excommunicated from a number of churches. He was publicly excommunicated for his polygamy from the Faith Assembly Fellowship. Your grandfather publicly excommunicated him from the Branham Tabernacle. And I want to say roughly 1973 is when his excommunication from Branham Tabernacle happened. But he continued to have a good relationship with lots and lots of message preachers, and still travel and still visit a lot of the international conventions even after his excommunication in the early 70s. So one other important thing about J.T. Parnell, John, is I have mentioned before, the reason the marriage and divorce tape is in circulation today is actually in large part due to J.T. Parnell. When the people started to confront him over the polygamy, when he was excommunicated from MISAC, when your grandfather excommunicated him, he went to Perry Green and sought the release of the marriage and divorce tape, which Perry Green had a copy of. How Perry Green had a copy of it, I'm not exactly sure, but he did. And from Perry Green, the marriage and divorce tape was released so that J.T. Parnell could use that to try and justify the polygamy stuff, right? And again, you got to put Perry Green into the mix there with releasing that out, so people, and you could, Perry Green talks about this on tape actually when he was approached to release the tape. And Perry Green describes it more or less. He didn't really, and he's, it's so, this man's so dirty. He didn't really think that the prophet meant you could have polygamy, but he wanted to release the tape so people could hear for themselves, make up their own mind kind of a thing. And he let out the tape. And so, anyways, obviously, William Branham did, to the casual ear, endorse polygamy in that sermon, and the polygamists used that to great effect. J.T. Parnell recruited a fairly substantial number of churches and preachers actually into polygamy here in the United States, John. There were polygamous churches in Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, North Carolina, South Carolina, West Virginia, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Missouri that I am aware of. Okay, there are at least 10 states that had churches affiliated with J.T. Parnell's sect of the message. Now, there's other polygamous groups I'm aware of in the message in North America besides J.T. Parnell, but I'm aware for sure those 10 states have churches that came out of his sect of the message that all practice polygamy. And if I had to guess, there were maybe, in those 10 churches, there were maybe 500-ish practicing polygamists in those churches that came out of J.T. Parnell and his practices. Some of them have been in the news. One notable church is Dan Gallimore's church in Martinsville, Virginia. His church was in the news. He actually married a minor, which is what got him in the news. I think he took a minor as a second or third wife, I believe. And yeah, it is it's very unfortunate, this sect of the message. And there are still remnants of this sect of the message around today. And I will go as far as to say too, John, that I am aware of practicing polygamists that are still in the Jeffersonville message community to this very day.
You know, what's really odd about the ones who were denying that William Branham said these things, people who were in the inner circle of William Branham knew that he struggled with mental health problems, especially people like Gordon Lindsay, who watch William Branham suddenly disappear from the scene because he's in the midst of a mental health crisis. And Gordon Lindsay, as you know, started bringing in other evangelists to try to keep the Voice of Healing revivals and Voice of Healing publication running. Well, Branham's off the scene. He's nearly incapacitated with mental health. But then in the later years, William Branham spouted off some of the weirdest, strangest things. And he did not just do it on the recordings. He did it also in private. You can hear the private testimonies of people who are saying that they spent time with William Branham and he had this, ooh, this very, very special thing that he said. And when you hear it, you're scratching your head thinking, what on earth was he actually saying there? It sounds so crazy. Like, I don't know if you remember, there's this guy that traveled around from church to church talking about William Branham's pyramid vision, how off recording William Branham claimed that all of our houses, whenever we get to heaven, won't be houses like we have today. They're going to be little rooms in this great giant pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid is where Jesus Christ lives. But you can't go up to the top very easily. He's up there. We're down here. I don't know if you heard this, but as a kid, part of me wanted to believe it because I'm sitting in a room filled with adults who are listening to this guy talk this nonsense. And, they're all eating it up, believing it. And so I'm looking around the room thinking, well, wait, am I really supposed to believe this? This sounds a little crazy. But those are the kind of crazy things that William Branham said off recording. We have witnesses that will attest to the weird things that William Branham said. So these guys knew that William Branham was a nut job. Many of them who were in the inner circle, they knew it. But whenever he went off the rails and the recording leaks out, they all deny that he said these things. And some of the things that he said off record, and even in the case of marriage and divorce, where he's talking about polygamy, supporting it on the record, he also had other places where on the record he rejected polygamy. So the nut job could not contain himself, and he's putting these things on recording, and the recording leaked out. And like you said, this is how polygamy just became widespread in the message. But the fact that the elders and leaders of the cult knew it and then denied it places every one of those ministers and evangelists for the message, it places their character in question. Which again goes back to, like I said, the fruit of the message. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John MacKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
The next one I want to talk about is Paul Azir Lowry. Now, this one, we can spend just a little more time talking about this one than the first two. So, Paul Azir Lowry, who is he? Paul Azir Lowry was a man we've mentioned a number of times. He was an Indian from India. He met William Branham during his India tour, which was a flop in the 1950s. He ended up following William Branham back here to Jeffersonville, like so many other people did. And he attended in Jeffersonville. He was baptized. I believe Orman Neville baptized him. He came after Orman Neville had become pastor. Orman Neville baptized him. He followed William Branham around a bit as part of his entourage. When everyone moved to Arizona from the Deity cult and so forth in the early part of 1963, he followed, and he also went to Arizona, John. He lived out there in the Tucson. He was actually in the Prescott commune of Leo and Gene Mercer for a while. And I consider Paul Zierlowry actually to be a breakaway from the Deity cult, John. If you think of the main sect has these various factions within it. One of those factions is the Tape Churches. Then within the Tape Churches, there's another sub-faction, the Deity cult. But the Deity cult is in there. Well, he was within that Deity cult faction. And the way I do that is I do that by observing their beliefs, what he teaches. He's actually teaching pretty close to the original Deity beliefs, but he's evolved them to point to himself after his death, or after the death of William Branham. So what happens, John? I should hold some more of these up. I have a track. This is one of Paul Zierlowry's tracks. I have tracks from a lot of these guys, John. You know, just great stuff. You know, some of this stuff is very, very entertaining, you know, to read. Here's one of my favorites, Masters of Legalized Confusion and Their Puppets. This is a great read, John. I mean, I just got to see Masters of the Legalized Confusion and Their Puppets. I got to recommend this to anybody who likes to read, you know, message literature. But anyways, Paul Zierlowry has this here track right here. This is called Son of Man. And I have a number of newspaper articles about him as well that I could share, but maybe we can put a few of them up here on the screen as I talk about him. But so Paul Zierlowry, as William Branham died, he went back to India. And then he just got his mission stuff kind of started in India, right? Really the first message mission work in India. And then William Branham dies and he comes back to the United States. Well, after that, Lowry starts getting crazier and crazier and crazier. Now, at first, he's pretty tight with the main sect of the message, the Deity cult people as well, and he's pretty tight with Ewald Frank. There's pictures of him visiting Creffield Free Mission. He actually met Archie Martin, the missionary working in Brazil, and they actually made a tour together at one point as well. And so Paul Zierlowry, Archie Martin, Ewald Frank, all these guys are kind of in this mission network that is taking the message overseas. And as that happens, he establishes a number of churches in India. In this book, actually, John, he claims to have established 25 churches. There's a list of the names of the 25 churches here that he has established. So in 1969, John, while Lowry was in the United States touring and basically collecting funds, the missionaries would come back and they would travel the circuit and they would get donations to take back to fund their mission operations. That's what he was doing. So he was coming around the mission circuit in the United States, collecting money, then going back to India to help spread the message in India. Well, why he is in Chicago that year, it's 1969, the moon landing happens. And John, this is, as you and I know, one of the most bizarre of all message stories. So while Paul Zierlowry is watching the moon landing on television, Neil Armstrong gets out of the spaceship. He steps on the moon. He says, "This is one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." As Paul Zierlowry watched that on television, he said at that moment, he became the next manifested Son of God. Jesus Christ returned in him at that exact same moment that Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon. And he begins saying this as he continues his travel around the North American message circuit, John. And of course, almost everybody thinks, Paul Zierlowry, you are a nut job. And so he never gets to come back again after that. He basically, everyone thought he was a nut at that point because William Branham was the prophet and he's trying to step into his shoes. But John, he actually successfully convinces a number of families. I want to say somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 people in the United States and Canada actually believe his claims And as he's doing this, he's telling them the rapture is going to happen in 1972. Jesus Christ has returned in him. It starts his 3.5 year countdown, basically. And now the rapture is going to come in 1972. And so come follow me to India, because you can only make it in the rapture if you're with me in India. So anyways, some of these people from North America, a few from Europe also, go back with him to India along with his larger Indian following, and wait for the rapture in 1972. Now, Paul Azir Lowry's sector of the message has a few unique features. One of them is, I mean, they full on believe the deity cult stuff, John. They baptize and they pray in the name of the Lord Branham Christ. And they do it very openly. You know, a lot of the deity cult here in North America, it's more secretive, right? It's only a lot of the people in the deity cult have enough sense to know this is crazy sounding. And William Branham said, you know, not to do this stuff publicly, and they keep it quiet and it's private for the most part among the deity cult in North America. But a few radical nuts that have been indoctrinated in the deity cult take it public. And that's what Paul Azir Lowry was doing. He was taking public the already private beliefs of members of the deity cult. He learned this. He was out in Gene and Leo's commune with them, with Fred Soffman and some other people. That's where he learned this stuff. And so he's just taken that publicly. And anyway, he's got the deity cult beliefs. They baptize and pray in the name of the Lord Branham Christ. And he does this unusual thing where he's blending the message with Hindu mysticism, John. And if you remember, William Branham preached about, at times, he talked about the seven dimensions, and the dimensions were like higher levels bringing you closer to God. And the way that William Branham actually described those seven levels, seven dimensions, is actually the same way that is believed in Hindi mysticism. Like, he described the top level is the cosmic light, where you're with God. The lower levels is like where the ascended saints are. He described it in the exact same way that a Hindu guru would describe those seven layers, except instead of, you know, meeting the Hindu god in the top layer, you're meeting, you know, the Christian god. And instead of gurus at the layer below, it's saints, right? So he just kind of changed up the words, to better match Christian thinking. Well, what's interesting, John, is William Branham actually started preaching that at the same time Paul Azir Lowry showed up here in the United States. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a speculation, but I would say... probably Paul Azir Lowry is the one who planted those ideas in William Branham's mind, and he's, you know, that's where they came from. Well, anyways, Paul Azir Lowry, as he's going back and being in India, he takes that seven dimension thing, and that becomes a really important component of his overall teachings. And he's just increasingly blending William Branham's teachings with Hindi mysticism, and it's all about how to transcend up to the higher level and reach the seventh dimension, where you can be in the presence of God. And so that's what he's doing. Obviously, 1972 comes and goes, the rapture don't happen. Then he changes it to the raptures in 1977, which comes and goes and nothing happens. And his following exploded coming out in 1977, broke up into various other factions. They began to reach out to my sect of the message, to your sect of the message, John. They began to pull in missionaries from North America and Europe. And that is really how the message launched in India. And all the sects got invited into India as his group imploded in the late 70s.
You said something there that I want to go back and emphasize, because I don't think many people realize this, especially if you're indoctrinated in the message. When you're indoctrinated in the message, you think that all of these ideas, these doctrines, these prophecies, all of these things that William Branham was saying from his public stage persona came from William Branham, because he's the divine messenger from God. That's how you're trained and manipulated in the message. And if you're outside of the message looking in, you think, well, here's this nut job who's claiming to be a prophet, a self-proclaimed prophet, and he's coming up with all this nonsense. But no, that's not the case, man. William Branham's ministry was largely influenced by the men and women around him. And you can find clear evidence of this if you just simply read through the Voice of Healing magazines. Read in chronological order and watch the things being presented by other men, and then watch them enter into William Branham's ministry. A clear example of this is the UFO theology. Read Voice of Healing, and you can even see the covers on the magazines. As soon as there's UFO phenomenon resurging, I can't remember what year it is. It's like the mid-50s. As that's resurging, and all the ministers are saying, look, in the skies, we see the God. This is not a UFO. This is not an alien spaceship like they claim. These are angels or watchers or whatever they claimed. And then you watch William Branham start to repeat what he's saying, and he... That's how, ironically, he come up with his UFO theology, where a UFO is going to swoop down and take us to the rapture. That was one of his weird, just crazy doctrinal beliefs. And he's not saying that he is saying it because he's a little bit mentally unstable, but not simply because he's mentally unstable. He's working with other mentally unstable men who are influencing him. And now, whenever you think about the tree and the fruit that it bears, now disconnect all of the famous people that were connected to Branham, that some of them started cults, some of them did not turn out that bad. But just think about the nut jobs that were coming out of William Branham's ministry. Now think about them influencing Branham as he's influencing the splinter groups. You had this vicious cycle. So the tree that's bearing fruit, it's like it's grafting itself with the bad fruit, so that the main trunk gets worse and worse over time.
I agree. And one of the notable features of many sects of the message is that the greatest thing a message preacher can do is to have a revelation. I have a revelation. I now can tell you something from the Bible that nobody ever knew before. It was a hidden mystery. It's been revealed to me as a revelation, and now I can share it to you. And in order to, you know, for someone to be able to do that, to have a unique teaching that they can say was a unique revelation to them that they then shared and was accepted, it is a great source of pride to the average message preacher to be able to do that. I mean, you're probably aware of some of these things, John. Like, for a preacher in the message to be able to get a group of people to accept some unique new thing that God revealed to him is the height of accomplishment for the message preacher. Okay, and so there is this natural inclination of message preachers to try and find some unique niche idea, concept, and they'll call it a revelation, and get people to accept that niche new thing. Okay, and so that is going on constantly in the message. And if you can convince other people to believe it, right, you know, there's like this risk zone, right, there's a danger zone. The preacher's got his new idea, and it's make or break, right? It's really his big break if he can get people to accept it. But it's also the incredible dangerous risk, because if they reject it, then it's going to cause a schism and everything's going to go sideways. And so it's this danger zone when these new revelations come. And a lot of the way that the preachers will do it, John, is before they will preach their new revelation, they will talk to some other preachers and kind of spitball it behind the scenes. And what do you think about this? And more or less feel out the other preachers. Am I going to get whacked in the head if I preach this? You know, that's what's going on. Am I going to get thrown out of here if I preach this? And so this is happening with William Branham all the way. This has been going on all along. Yeah, Paul Azir Lowry wants to preach the seven dimension nonsense. He's whispering in William Branham's ear, what do you think about my seven dimension nonsense, William Branham? Oh, I like that. I like it so much, I'm going to preach it next Sunday. That is the sort of stuff that happens in the message, okay? And then Paul Azir Lowry can go preach it. But this is very commonplace in the message.
Yeah, that's the problem exactly. And, you know, if you're a Christian, I know we have people listening who aren't, but if you are a Christian and you think about the false God that this is presenting, and especially if you consider the deity cult and how the deity cult is coming into play here, you have men who are worshiping Branham. Branham knows it. He admits it on recording that he knows it. He somewhat publicly condemns it, but then, as we've mentioned, the people, the very people who are believing him to be God, he's appointing to power and leadership positions in the cult. So as they start to come into the picture and the cycle begins where the splinter groups are influencing the main sect, they're influencing Branham directly. So the God complex, I guess you would call it, goes to William Branham's head over time, and this turns into this big theological mess.
I agree. Let me move on to our next group to talk about. So this group is called, often referred to as the Third Testament group, and their leader is a man named Donald Parnell. No relation to J.T. Parnell, as best I know. This is another Parnell family. So this group would also be considered a breakaway of the Deity cult, John. Donald Parnell was a man, when you listen to him talk, spent a fair amount of time with Fred Sothman and with Alfred Erickson, who are two very notable men from the Branham Deity cult, the main Deity cult that controlled the central institutions of the message. And a lot of the ideas he shares and preaches are straight up the deity beliefs of the main branch of the Deity cult. However, what he did is he kind of adjusted them a little bit, John, and here's how he adjusted them. In the main sect of the message, the Deity cult that is embedded in the main sect believes that after William Branham, the next manifested son of God is Joseph, his son, right? Like, that's how it is looked at in the main sect. Joseph is now their object of worship. Well, Donald Parnell said, no. It's me, Donald Parnell. And so naturally he schismed with the Deity cult, okay? And so anyways, he's teaching basically the same beliefs of the Deity cult, except he's redirected it to now he is the successor of William Branham, and he actually plainly teaches he's the third incarnation of Jesus Christ, and he claims that Jesus came back into him in 2005, actually, is the date on which he claims to have become this incarnation. My book on message history, I only go up to 2005, so I felt like I had to kind of add him in here. But for most of his message career, he was just, I would consider him just a rank-and-file deity cult member, John, until he got the idea that he himself had become, a manifested son of God. Now, his group is called the Third Testament because they believe you have the Old Testament, right? You have the New Testament. And William Branham's sermons now form the Third Testament. So the First Covenant is expired. The Jesus Christ and the Apostle Covenant is expired. And now they're living under the covenant which William Branham taught as the Second Coming. And now here's Donald Parnell as the Third Coming. So it's a very bizarre sect of the message, John. They believe that the rapture occurred roughly in 1963, and that they've been in the millennial age since 1963, and that because we're now in the millennial age, anybody can ascend to become a manifested son of God and become a theophany, is how they would term it. I'll be honest, I've only listened to about a dozen of Donald Parnell's sermons, John. They're crazy. They're wacko. But he basically says that everybody can become a theophany. Let me read you a quote from Donald Parnell. He says, "You need to listen to your theophany. Walk in your theophany. Guide yourself in your theophany. Imagine yourself in your theophany. Wrap yourself around your theophany." And a lot of his teachings are focused on people elevating themselves to manifested Son of God level, which in his terminology is often the term theophany. So as far as people in his group, I mean, there's a few churches and several hundred people that follow his teachings. They're primarily in North America. I believe he has followers in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and Michigan. So another notable regional sect of the message.
One of the other weird things that he taught was that we're now living in the millennial age, because I think I gave this story in one of the episodes that we did early on, but after I'd left the message, I was in the post office and I kept running into people who were in the message, and they, I hate to say it, but they acted very, very childish. They would look at me in scorn and walk away, or I have these mental images of them sticking their tongue out at me as they're leaving me, but they basically just gave me the stink eye and then left. But then this one guy in the post office, he watched me walk in and he turned around and he shook my hand and he smiled and he said, "You're John Collins, aren't you?" And I knew him. I knew he was in the message, and I expected he was going to give me some wild insult like the rest of the church. But he looked at me and he said, "You're John Collins." I said, "Yeah." He said, I know what you're doing is, against William Branham. And I just wanted to say, I'm not going to condemn you for that." And I was a little surprised. And he says, "It really doesn't matter what you do." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "We're living in the millennial age. Jesus Christ has come and gone. I was in the meetings at Shreveport, and I watched Jesus Christ come down on the platform in the name of William Branham, as William Branham." And I looked at him, and I scratched my head, and he said, "It doesn't matter what you do. You can condemn William Branham if you want. You can go sleep with all kinds of prostitutes and other women if you want, because it doesn't matter. We're living in the..." This guy literally said this. This is a man who's claiming to be... Well, he uses the word Christian. I wouldn't use the same word, but he's telling me that I can go live the life of sin like some guy off the street, and it doesn't matter because we're living in the millennial age. And that's the fruit of this message. Whenever they're saying that they're Christian or they're using the words Jesus, some of the bad apples, and from the main trunk of the tree, some of the bad apples don't even have a concept of what Christianity is.
I agree, John. I mean, it is, by the time you get into these groups that really deeply believe that the second coming already happened, like most of the message believes some sort of a second coming of Christ spiritually happened in the ministry of William Branham. But the ones who, like, there's like a line. I don't know how to describe this for outsiders. Okay. There's a group who they believe, yeah, it spiritually happened and somehow it's all still in progress and Jesus is still going to come back bodily and then there's going to be a heavenly age. There's that group. But then there's others who they don't believe that anymore. Jesus came and this is it. This is it, ladies and gentlemen. It's great. Those are the craziest ones. They're living in the millennial age and now they need to get their rapturous, glorified bodies and they do crazy, bizarre things to go get that. Yeah, it's hard to even relate that to authentic Christianity because of the things that have happened. And some of them are so crazy, and they're so prone to extremism, John. I mean, just absolute extremism. You listen to some of these people we've mentioned, you can go on YouTube and you can look their sermons, and you can listen in for yourself, and hear the stuff that they're saying. And some of it is, it's incredibly bizarre.
Like I said at the beginning of this episode, that one passage of scripture talking about beware of false prophets and going on to say you will know them by their fruits. This is the fruit of the message. You have people that believe everything from abstaining from sex and do not produce children to have as many wives as you want, and oh, by the way, you can sleep around with whoever you want. That's the extremes of this message. And those, I don't care who you are. If you're in the message and you say, "Well, this is just a bad apple," don't listen to those. Those people don't represent the true message. You have to understand that many of those people who have these weird, wacky ideas were actually influencing Branham, and their influences made it into the message. So the tree was turning rotten from the inside as it was growing. That's how bad this is.
We didn't make it through all these smaller sects of the message, so we're going to have to come back next time and knock out some more. We've got at least one more substantial, smaller sect of the message I want to talk about, maybe two. Actually three. Daggone it. I'm looking here, John. I got five more in here. There's more in here than I thought, so I think we've got enough to fill another episode pretty easily.
I don't know how you stop it at five, man. There's no telling how many hundreds, if not thousands, of these things that there are. I was working with a couple people in another country, and they were just literally two men had started a message sect that was a splinter group off of one of the branches that we've mentioned, and they started gathering a following and they turned into this weird destructive cult. And like all of these other bad apples that we're talking about, the main sect, and I mean, even some of the sects of the message that are closer to the main disavowed them and said these guys are just nut jobs. They're a product of the main tree of the message. So we have plenty more to go to. I'll just say it like that. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about the history of William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion from Christian Identity to the NAR, both available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.